Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Yesterday, then, we began our overview, our seminar about these 10 subjects of Srimad Bhagavatam, based on the descriptions given in Tattva Sandarbha. And we went through text 56. One little point I could note here, it's like just a structural consideration in regards to Tattva Sandarbha itself. Where it says 56.1, and then, you know, there's some text, and then it's 56.2, and there's some more text. That division has been done not by Jiva Goswami. It's been done by us, or actually it's been done by Gopi Puranadana Prabhu. Oh, another point. Is there still anyone who doesn't have one of the overview books? What did he say he was going to do? Oh, I thought you spoke to him about it. Oh, what a shame. So, could you just run out and tell him we need, how many is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 4 more overview books. Actually came in with a few in his hand, I think. So I assume there are more. So where would he be? Where does Subal reside? In this first room. Is it the first or the second one? Anyway, the second one, yeah. Just out here, if you can. Okay, so this 56.1, 56.2, and so on, you'll see in most of the verses they're divided up. Gopi Puranadana Prabhu divided up that in that way, just for the sake of what? I guess the sake of just not overburdening our relatively smaller minds. So it is just like a managerial consideration, you could say. It's not that actually there is a 56.1 and a 56.2. There is a verse 56, in fact. Yeah. But just for the sake of clarity for us and ease of understanding like that, Gopi Puranadana Prabhu divided it up in this way. So anyway, yesterday, it was basically like an introduction, a little bit of the background to the Sandarbhas, and a little bit of background to the subject of these 10 topics. Shukadev Goswami, there in the 10th chapter of the second canto, has given us these 10 topics, and now we're going to go through several verses or so, which are going to elaborate on them. And this is important because for a book to be a Purana, it has to be of a certain type, or the subject matter has to be of a certain type. You can't just call anything a Purana. So these Puranas, they are structured in very, very specific ways. These Mahapuranas. Yesterday we mentioned briefly about Mahapurana. It has these 10 topics. Not only Srimad Bhagavatam, actually. It's not that this is just the 10 topics of Srimad Bhagavatam, but this is the 10 topics of a Mahapurana, and Srimad Bhagavatam happens to be a Mahapurana. Actually, it's the supreme Mahapurana. But then, when you come down a step and you get a Purana, then a Purana has 5 of these 10. And we'll talk about which when we get to verse 61, because that analyzes this whole subject matter in more depth. Otherwise, It may be, anyway, it could be an upaparana, alpaparana. Then there's itihasa. Itihasa means history. So it's again a little different. Otherwise you could just say, well, itihasa, I mean, seeing we've mentioned it, itihasa, or rather say purana, purana is not dealing with just one narration about, you know, like Ramayana. Ramayana is an itihasa. It is historical. It is dealing with Lord Ram. But Puranas deal with many subjects of a historical nature. I mean, at least the historical element will be there. But there'll be many taken from different times, not necessarily chronologically, and put together like that. But itihasa, which is also historical, and it's more like just purely historical, in that, like in Ramayana, it's just about Lord Ram. It's not about anybody else. Mahabharata is essentially about the Pandavas. It's not really about anybody else. So this is the difference between an itihasa and a purana. Yeah, so Jiva Goswami discussed a little bit about that. There are these 10 topics. And then he made it very clear that the 10th is the main one, and the other 9 are supportive. Well, the other 9 are just linked up, and they are helping clarify the 10th and elaborate on the 10th. It's not like they're just 10 subjects and they're independent of each other. So that we talked about yesterday, and we gave mentioned briefly a couple of examples, and I said I'd give some more tonight. Shukadeva Goswami, in the second of those two verses, second canto, chapter 10, verse 2, he said that to clarify the meaning of the tenth subject, the great souls describe the characteristics of the first 9 subjects by prayers, by indirect explanations, and direct explanations. So I said I would give you a little bit more in the way of examples. So, just a little bit. I'm going to read a couple of verses from Lord Shiva's song, 4th canto, chapter 24. I assume you're aware, you know, you understand the structure of Srimad Bhagavatam enough to know what this is. So, Lord Shiva, this is the song sung by Lord Shiva. And I'll just read 2 or maybe 3 verses or so. So Lord Shiva says, "My Lord, you are the origin of the creation. By virtue of the lotus flower which sprouts from your navel." So what's that in terms of the 10 topics or the first 9? Well, you know what? I guess it's sarga, actually, yeah. Because sarga ends with the lotus flower. It begins with the glance and ends with the lotus flower. And as soon as Lord Brahma appears, now you go into Visarga, the secondary creation, or Lord Brahma takes over, in other words. So you're the origin of the creation by virtue of the lotus flower which sprouts from your navel. This is one of the verses of Lord Shiva, and that's about Sarga. You are the origin of the creation by virtue of the lotus flower. So that's the last step in Sarga, the primary creation. The Lord himself, from his own navel, manifests that lotus flower. Then Brahma appears, and then Brahma takes over. You are the supreme controller of the senses and the sense objects. What does that sound like to you? Sorry? Okay, but of the 10 topics. Mm-hmm. Stana. This is more to do with Stana. You are the supreme controller of the senses and sense objects. In other words, you are running things. You are maintaining. Stana means to maintain. Then he says, you're also the all-pervading Vasudev. You are most peaceful, and because of your self-illuminated existence, you are not disturbed by the six kinds of transformations. This is a little more of the nature of Ashraya, his supreme unique position as an individual, not just some functional types of descriptions. My dear Lord, you are the origin of the subtle material ingredients, the master of all integration. What does that sound like? That's pretty obvious, isn't it? Speak up, someone. You are the origin of the subtle material ingredients. Sarga, of course. Yeah. That's Sarga. My Lord, you are the authority by which the doors of the higher planetary systems and liberation are opened. What does that sound like? Well, you could say there's an element of Mukti's there. I would have thought that it is a bit more on the side of Manvantara. Well, at least the Manvantara element is there. Of course, we haven't discussed Manvantara yet, what it means in more detail. We just said it's the periods of the Manus. But as we're going to read in 57 just now, Shukadev Goswami and Jiva Goswami, they explain that actually when we say Manvantara, we don't just mean some period of time or some particular individuals, but the Manus, their business, their duty is that they give the laws for humanity. In other words, they're very important in terms of like the dissemination of the Vedas and religious systems for human beings, the Manus. Like, for example, in Bhagavad Gita chapter 4, verse 1, Krishna tells Arjuna that I instructed this to Vivasvan, and Vivasvan Manave Praha. Vivasvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind. So Manu is a very important, religious authority for the human beings. So when it comes to, see here he says, my Lord, you're the authority by which the doors of the higher planetary systems and liberation are opened. Higher planetary systems, that is to do with Manu. It's his business to give those types of religious principles through the Vedas, how you can be elevated materially. But it's also his business to give the scriptures. The Vedic scriptures also describe mukti. Yeah. So therefore I felt that even though, you can say the element of mukti is there, but really it's more to do with Manvantara, because he's talking about the Lord as the authority, the person who's giving the knowledge about these things. So this is really, this knowledge is given and transmitted and maintained by the Manus. Now I've got, let's read, say, a verse or two from the prayers of the personified Vedas. So the Shrutis, the personified Vedas, they say, "Victory, victory to you, O unconquerable one. By your very nature, you're perfectly full in all opulences. Therefore, please defeat the eternal power of illusion, who assumes control over the modes of nature to create difficulties for conditioned souls." What does that sound like to you? Someone, come on, let's... Poshana, did you say? Yes, that's what it seems like to me. It's an appeal for mercy. Poshana means mercy. So, the devotees appeal for it, the Lord gives it. That's Poshana. Okay, then, let's see. O you who awaken all the energies of the moving and non-moving embodied beings. Sometimes the Vedas can recognize you as you sport with your material and spiritual potencies. So it's more particularly the first part there. O you who awaken all the energies of the moving and non-moving embodied beings. What's that? That's more Sarika, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so this is the idea. And then a direct description. Jiva Goswami, who wrote his own commentary on this book, he explains that when, you know, their prayers, their direct explanations, and their indirect explanations, he says direct explanations mean where someone is just like directly describing the Lord, what he's like. So, and the prayer, Lord Kapila's description to Devahuti is given as an example. Kapila says that you should meditate on the Lord in this way. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has a cheerful, lotus-like countenance with ruddy eyes like the interior of a lotus and a swarthy body like the petals of a blue lotus. He bears a conch, discus, and mace in three of his hands. He also wears around his neck a garland of attractive sylvan flowers and a swarm of bees, intoxicated by its delicious fragrance, hums about the garland. He is further superbly adorned with a pearl necklace, a crown, and pairs of armlets, bracelets, and anklets. So this is an example of a direct explanation. It's talking specifically about the Lord and what he is like as a person. Not just that you're responsible for this, you're responsible for that. You know, you're controlling things and so on like that. But you are like this. This is a direct explanation. Then indirect, well, we mentioned yesterday, and actually Jiva Goswami, in fact, gives it as an example. An indirect explanation, the example we gave was Parikshit in the womb of Uttara, and the Lord intervened. And another example, which is given by Jiva Goswami, is how Shukadev was captivated by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. You know that story. Shukadev Goswami was in the womb of his mother for 16 years, and his father Vyasadeva complained after 16 years that, come on, You must come out. You can't just carry on like this. And because his wife, Shukadev's mother, had complained that, you know, it's getting a bit uncomfortable. Can you imagine having a 16-year-old? Anyway, Hare Krishna. So therefore Vyasadev complained or, you know, requested. And Shukadev said, well, I don't know. It's Maya out there. And Vyas said, well, it's Maya in there also. But Shukadev said, well, it's easier to deal with the Maya in here because it's not so attractive. But if I go out and see that Maya, you know, it's all sort of, you know, colorful and I might get bewildered. But in here it's okay. It's nothing to distract me. So like this, they're going back and forth. But Vyas, you know, he was quite determined, so he kept arguing. And eventually Shukadev told him, look, you're just materially motivated. You're a henpecked husband. You're doing this because your wife is on your case. So you don't actually have my best interest at heart. Or at least I'm not confident that you really do. So therefore I don't want to do it because I have reservations. So then Vyas asked that if I bring Krishna and he guarantees that you won't fall down if you come out, will you come out? So Shukadev said, okay. So Krishna came all the way from Dwaraka and gave his guarantee. So Shukadev came out and immediately ran away. But then what happened was Vyas wanted to train him up further. But Vyas was thinking how to get him to come back so I can train him up further. Then he figured out, because he had been speaking Srimad Bhagavatam while Shukadev was in the womb. And he knew Shukadev really liked it. So he thought, well, Vyas, what he did was he sent some of his students out and said, just recite certain verses. They're like the most beautiful verses in the Bhagavatam. Just recite those verses. Just walk around, just around the country. And after a while, you'll probably see one naked and rather sort of, you know, avaduta type young boy is going to just start following you. Because they didn't know what Shukadev looked like, because he just left immediately, those students. So when you see this, then you can know this is probably Shukadev. So just keep reciting the verses, but come straight back here. So in this way, so they did it, and actually Shukadev did come back, and then Vyas did instruct him further in Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah, so this is an example. It's an indirect explanation. You know, it's basically Shukadev and Vyas and their whole situation. But the Lord is in there. And then, of course, you know, things like the story of Prahlad. Nrisingadev is appearing there and saving Prahlad. But, you know, the story, there's so much all about Prahlad and who he was and what happened and Hiranyakashipu and so on. Then, so there's some examples. And, you know, you can look through, as you're looking through, as you're reading Srimad Bhagavatam, as I assume you all read the Bhagavatam from time to time, then you can look with this in mind, that what is, you know, someone is discussing something, so what is this in terms of the 10 topics? And then you'll be able to relate what we're studying here and apply it in your practical daily activities. So now we're going to go on to text 57. So, okay, well let's just read 57.1. To elucidate the tenth subject, Sri Shukadev Goswami speaks seven verses defining each of the ten subjects. Just catch what he says. To elucidate the tenth subject, Shukadev Goswami speaks seven verses defining each of the ten subjects. Yeah. But the idea is to connect up with the tenth subject. So what we find now is then in 57, as it says here, four of the seven verses are as follows. So these are the next four verses. Well, the seven are the next seven verses in the tenth chapter. We just yesterday read verse 1 and verse 2. And they're just establishing what are the ten topics, listing them out basically. But now, the next seven, from 3 to 9, they are describing the ten in more detail, but the first four of them are describing the nine. Okay? And that means that the last three of them are describing the tenth. Did I make that clear? Let me just say it again. The first two that we read yesterday, chapter 10, verse 1 and 2, just listing out the ten topics. The next seven, from verse 3 to 9, are going into some detail about all the ten, all those ten. However, the first four of the next seven are describing the first nine, and the last three of the next seven are discussing only the tenth topic. And we'll see as we go through in this 57, because it's going through all. Tonight we're going to go through all the nine, the first nine. And you'll see how Jiva Goswami and Shukadev actually, they are connecting. Generally they're connecting them up to the tenth. Okay, so now this is the first then of the next seven. The primary creation of the five gross elements, the five subtle sense objects, the five senses, the mahatattva and the false ego, resulting from the disturbance in the material mode's equilibrium caused by the Supreme Lord, is known as sarga. The secondary creation affected by Lord Brahma is called Visarga. So there we have the first two, Sarga and Visarga. The five subtle sense objects, well, first of all, the five gross elements, that obviously means earth, water, fire, air, and ether. The five subtle sense objects, that sound, form, taste, smell, touch, and the five senses, means the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin. So this is all sarga. It's all this results from the disturbance in the material mode's equilibrium caused by the Supreme Lord, meaning Mahavishnu, who glances on the pradhan, which is the unmanifest form of matter. And that glance, within that glance, is the kala shakti, the time energy, the icha shakti, The potency of the Lord's desire. What is the Lord's desire? That the whole creation start again. And, you know, the whole material world get operational again. Because everything is in an unmanifest state. Plus, you and me, us, we're there. In the glass. So all these different things. First of all, the time. Energy. This is Brahma Samhita, basically, and we're not going to digress into a whole Brahma Samhita thing, but basically, in very simple terms, the disturbance caused by the glands means that, first of all, the time energy contacts that pradhan, that it is... I mean, it probably is what the scientists mean when they say the primordial soup. You know, it's just a great conglomeration of all the material constituent elements of all different types. All these types mentioned here. At that point, when they're pradhan, they're all mixed up together. And you can't see that, oh, here is the earth. There's the water over there. There's the fire. There's the sense of smell, and so on. It's just like a soup, really. But then he glances, and the time energy agitates the modes. And when the modes get agitated and start sort of hubbling and bubbling or whatever, and then all these other things start to unfold or separate out, you could say. You know, when we do the Brahma Samhita course, actually, we do give the example of a soup, the primordial soup, or any soup, that what happens here is pretty much exactly a reverse form of making a soup. Because when you make a soup, you know, where you just cook it down until everything just merges, that sort of soup. Then, you know, you may have different vegetables in there and some salt and some this and some that. But now you can't, by looking at it, you can't see. So here, you know, in the beginning it's like that. But then he glances and then the different constituent elements separate themselves from each other. Just like when you make a soup in the beginning, all the different ingredients are separated from each other, but then they gradually merge. So here there's, you know, if you filmed someone making a soup and then played it in reverse, it's something like that, that gradually you'll see, oh, here comes the earth. And, oh, look over there. Here comes the fire. I don't know if it's quite like that, but something like that. Until you get Mahatattva. And Mahatattva means everything is separated out. And then Lord Vishnu puts a little bit of everything inside each universe. And then Lord Brahma comes and takes all those things and puts them together. And, you know, here we are today. This all happened on that basis. Do you get the idea? Anyway, as I say, I don't want to go too much into detail there. But that part of the creation, beginning from the glance, which then starts sort of extracting all the different ingredients out, that's sarga. And then visarga is what Brahma does. So Jiva Goswami explains further here, the rest of 57.1. The Buddhas mentioned here are the five gross material elements beginning with ether. The matras are the subtle elements, sound and so on. The indriyas are the perceptive senses. The word di, intelligence, indicates the totality of unmanifest matter together with false ego. Brahman, the supreme controller. Notice he doesn't say Krishna, the supreme controller. He's still, you know, he's not going into the fine analysis of what the absolute truth is, but he's presenting still in a little bit of a general sense what really the absolute truth is, or the Ashraya, as Krishna. That's going to come out. Actually, it's only going to really come out in the Krishna Sandarbha, in terms of his presentation. So Brahman, the supreme controller, generates these physical and non-physical elements by causing the modes of material nature to become unbalanced and produce transformations. That's what we were talking about, the glance and the time, Kala Shakti. This is called Sarga creation. The secondary creation by Lord Brahma is called Visarga. Since he is the Vairaja Purusha, or universal person, his creation is also called Purusha. So, just like Stana can be called Stiti, we mentioned yesterday, so Visarga can also be called Purusha. Visarga is the sending forth of moving and non-moving living beings and everything connected with it. Okay. So that's that. That's the first two. Seven more to go. So 57.2. Here we have another two of these verses. Verse 4 and verse 5. And here we are going to find that the next five are described. Okay, let's just read through. Stiti. Notice that it's actually in the Sanskrit. Verse 4, the very first word is stiti. What we otherwise call sthana, we mentioned that yesterday, that the two terms are synonymous. Stiti is the victory of Lord Vishnu. You might think, oh, that's strange. We said it was maintenance. What's it got, you know, maintenance got to do with the victory of Lord Vishnu? Okay, we'll come to that shortly. And Poshana is the grace he bestows on his devotees. So it's not just mercy. It is the mercy of the Lord on his devotees. So, see the connection there with the Ashraya. There's a very clear connection with the Ashraya. It's not just mercy in a broad sense. It's mercy in the sense of the Lord being kind to the devotees and acting as their shelter. Ashraya. The word Manvantara indicates the principles of transcendental religion. Yes, it's not. It doesn't just mean the Manus as people or the periods of time, because the term Manvantara is also used just as a term for the period of time. There are 14 Manvantaras in one day of Brahma. But here, when we say Manvantara as one of the 10 topics, we don't just mean, you know, the period of time or himself, each Manu as an individual. We're talking about the specific function of the Manus, which is that they maintain the principles of religion for humanity. This is what they do. They supervise the human beings. And that means specifically in terms of the Vedic knowledge and having it available and seeing they're following it like that. So then, uti refers to, we said desire yesterday. But it's not just desire, any type of desire. It's specifically desire for material activity. And in the Bhagavatam, there are different places where, you know, there are graphic descriptions of people with material desire. Like in the 5th canto, right? Is it the 16th chapter or the 14th chapter? The material world as the forest of enjoyment. There's a very graphic description of how they try to enjoy, but then fail to enjoy. And, you know, they're all meant to take shelter of the Lord. So it's all connected up with the ashraya there again. So uti refers to desires for material activities. Ishanu Kata indicates the various descriptions of the Lord's pastimes in his incarnations and also the descriptions of his faithful devotees' activities. So there we've got another five. Stiti or Stana, Poshana, Manvantara, Uti, and Ishanu Kata. Got it? So let's read what he says, because now Jiva Goswami is going to elaborate a bit. And it is interesting, actually. Stiti, maintenance, is Vaikuntha Vijay. That's what it says, in fact, in the verse. Stitir Vaikuntha Vijaya. Stiti means Vaikuntha Vijaya, or the victory of Lord Vaikuntha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, stiti indicates the supreme glory of the Lord shown by his maintaining all created beings in their respective situations under his laws. So what does this mean? It means that only the Lord can do this, maintain. Even the greatest demigods, even Brahma and Shiva, what to speak of Indra and others, they cannot maintain. So, Vaikuntha Vijay, the victory of Lord Vishnu, it means not exactly that he went and fought with someone and had a victory, but he is victorious in the sense that he's greater than Brahma and Shiva. That's his victory. His victory is that he's superior, in that he can maintain, but the others can't. Do you get the idea? Anyone not get the idea? Yeah, the victory is that he is supreme. His supremacy is shown, not that he fights Brahma and Shiva, but by the fact that he maintains. So therefore, stiti Vaikuntha Vijaya. The stiti, the maintenance, is the symptom of his victory. His supremacy. So, as he says, in other words, stiti indicates the supreme glory of the Lord, which is shown by his maintaining all created beings. Okay, that's stiti. Then poshanam, sustenance, indicates how he maintains his devotees by bestowing his grace on them. Manvantarani, periods of manus, indicates the histories of the manus and other saintly kings who ruled during the manus' reigns, and also the histories of other saintly people who lived during those periods and received the Supreme Lord's favor. Okay, so we mentioned that a bit. How it is specifically referring to this function of the manus as the maintainers of religion. And what does that mean? It means Krishna consciousness, the connection with the ashraya. That's what it means, ultimately. But then again, it's not just the manus, because sometimes some saintly kings help them. And not only saintly kings, but sometimes some great devotees come along and maintain the principles of religion and teach the principles of religion, and distribute the principles of religion amongst humanity. Meaning Krishna consciousness, like Srila Prabhupada. So Srila Prabhupada's activities fall into the category of Manvantarani. Okay. Then, let's see. Oh yeah. He goes on actually to say a little bit more about Manvantarani. The deeds of these saints are themselves religious standards, establishing the Saddharma, transcendental religion of worshipping the Lord, the Ashraya. Now, if you remember, actually, well, let's just carry on because he's going to bring out a point which could possibly be a little confusing, but I don't think it needs to be. With regard to universal maintenance, uti, impetuses for action, are desires for various fruitive activities. So that's interesting. This is now a slant on material desire. It's not just material desire. So, it's referring to, you know, like the fundamental condition of the living entity as a rebellious conditioned soul who has rebelled against the Ashraya, is trying now to take shelter in his material desires and material things, but is going to fail and take shelter again, hopefully. So like this is uti. And then, Ishanukata, narrations about the Lord, are historical accounts of the Lord's pastimes in his various incarnations, as well as accounts of his faithful followers' activities. So, when I said there might possibly be some confusion, here it's referring also to the devotees. Ishanukata includes descriptions of the devotees, but Manvantara also includes descriptions of the devotees, but they're different types of descriptions. The Manvantara descriptions are specifically to do with teaching and distributing Vedic knowledge like this. But the Ishanukata descriptions of the devotees are more just, you know, in a general sense, their activities, their life stories, and, you know, without specifically having that focus of instructing people and distributing the knowledge. You know, obviously there may be some overlapping there, but this is the basic idea. When Manvantara refers to the devotees, it is referring to them specifically as preachers and teachers, and actually doing that. Descriptions of them actually doing that. But Ishanukata descriptions of the devotees is more general about their lives and so on. Of course, he also makes the point, isn't it, that the deeds of these saints are themselves religious standards. You know, so in a certain sense, you can't really separate them like, you know, here's the Manvantara parts and here are the Ishanukata parts. But still, there is some sense of separation, and this is Bhed Abhed Tattva. Yeah. There is and isn't a distinction, but there is also, so we should acknowledge that. So now we've done 7 of the 9. If we go over the page to 57.3, then we do the other two. The merging of the living entity along with his conditioning, with the mystic lying down of Mahavishnu, is called the winding up of the cosmic manifestation, Nirodha. That's number 8. Liberation, mukti, is not just any form of liberation, impersonal merging or whatever, but mukti is specifically the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross and subtle material bodies. In fact, this is a very, very famous line, or two lines really, of this Srimad Bhagavatam verse. I'm sure you've heard it before. Muktir hitvanyata rupam swarupena vyavastati. That's what the verse says. That mukti means swarupena. Not just any sort of liberation, but when you're in your swarup, yes, your eternal, natural, constitutional position, that means as a devotee. Jivera swarup hoya Krishnera nityadas. That impersonal liberation, even though the term mukti is used for it, but it is not really in an absolute and unconditional sense mukti. It's a temporary type of mukti. So real mukti means swarupena vyavastiti. When you are, again, actually, isn't it interesting? The word stiti is there also. Swarupena vyavastiti. When you are situated, being, you're maintaining that position of swarup. So actually, mukti means the permanent situation of the living entity as the eternal servant of the Lord, connected with the Ashraya. That's what it is. So in this way we can see the connection with the Ashraya is coming out bit by bit. So then Jiva Goswami gives a little bit of an explanation. When annihilation occurs after a period of universal maintenance, Lord Hari goes to sleep, means Mahavishnu. And the jivas follow him along with their energies, their upadis. This is called Nirodha. Their upadis. Okay. Upadi literally means designation. So, it means, actually what it means is their subtle bodies, all their karma, everything is sort of compressed in on top of them. And they remain cocooned in these things. Then they go to sleep. That's called susupti. We're talking now about the winding up of the creation, when Mahavishnu inhales. So actually what happens according to Brahma Samhita is that time stops functioning. Or not just stops functioning, but the time energy is withdrawn. When the time energy is withdrawn, then the three modes have not got anything to push them on as they work, you know, going from this state to that state. So the three modes become suspended, bang. Suspended animation. Three modes stop. What does that mean? It means you stop getting your karma. You may still have plenty left. But it's not that, you know, one after another, which is what is happening now. Your reactions are coming here. Take a reaction. Bang. You know, here, take another reaction. someone steals something from you. Here, take another reaction. Maybe someone gives something to you. So this is all being impelled by the combined effects of time and the three modes which are being moved by time. Your reactions are coming one after the other. But when there's no time, then your reactions, the modes, and your reactions stop. So then the living entity goes into that state of susupti, deep sleep, and is cocooned in the karma. Does that make sense? Have we bewildered anyone by saying that? Too much? Okay, let's just leave it at that for the time being. Well, that's basically what happens. So this is the annihilation. Actually, there's more to it, which Sutta Goswami will bring out. This is just a simple description of Nirodha, the annihilation, the destruction. But there are different levels to it, which Sutta Goswami brings out. Okay. When annihilation occurs, after a period of universal maintenance, Lord Hari goes to sleep and the jivas follow him, along with their energies, their upadis, their karma, their subtle bodies, their desires, all these things. They are cocooned within them. This is called Nirodha. Lord Hari's going to sleep consists of his closing his eyes to the material creation. You know, in order for him to glance, what did he have to do? He had to open his eyes. Otherwise he couldn't have glanced. But now he closes his eyes. Simultaneous with inhaling, he closes his eyes. And everything just shuts down, basically. And the jivas going to sleep consists of their merging into Lord Hari. Well, you know, not exactly merge in the sense of homogeneousness, but they go into, they merge in that sense. They enter into the body of Mahavishnu. Just like the green bird going into the green tree. Looks like it just kind of became one with, but actually it didn't. Really. Just looks like that to the observer. Okay, then now mukti. If a jiva, in that merged state, now this is interesting. If a jiva in that merged state has freed himself from his false acquired nature, the ignorance and other qualities superimposed on him by material illusion, he attains his original nature. This is called mukti, liberation. So what's he saying here? Hope we're thinking about these things. He is saying that mukti occurs at that time. That's what he's saying. At the time of universal annihilation, mukti may occur. However, you know, if you're now thinking, gosh, does that mean I may have to wait? I mean, if I ever manage to achieve it anyway, but, you know, I may have to wait till the end of this day of Brahma. No, Jiva Goswami explains in his commentary that it can happen any time. It just refers to becoming a pure devotee. Yeah. And because when a person becomes a pure devotee, that means their karma is finished, their subtle bodies are finished, their upadis are finished. So what does that mean? It means that mukti is a form of annihilation. Isn't that interesting? Mukti is a form of annihilation. Because your karma, your subtle body, and all your upadis and everything, they're all destroyed. Otherwise, how could there be mukti? So mukti is a type of liberation, but Sudha Goswami will talk more about that. So Jiva Goswami says in his commentary that it is not only that a person could achieve liberation only at that time of universal annihilation, but any time the devotee can achieve it, but then there's an annihilation on that level, on the level of that individual's existence, there's an annihilation. Yeah. All right. So there we have a, brief but to the point description of the first nine. Any comments or questions? Yes. No. It's permanent mukti. It's a permanent mukti. Like, for example, there are descriptions in the Bhagavatam of Lord Brahma himself and some of his associates getting that mukti. Right? I don't know if you recall reading, there are descriptions of how, at the end of the day of Brahma or the end of his life, there's a devastation, and then he may go back to Godhead with his associates. So that is that type of mukti. Yeah. No, Swarup. As a devotee, yes. That's what the verse says. This is a famous verse. Because the impersonalists, this is one of the verses which our acharyas have extracted to defeat the impersonalists. Because here it's specifically talking about mukti. In fact, it's saying muktir hitvanyata rupam, which means the real form of mukti is swarupena. That is the real form of mukti. Muktir hitvanyata rupam. The real form of mukti is swarupena vyavastati, becoming situated in your actual swarup. Not just going and merging somewhere for a while. Not like that. Yes? It's just a secondary type of mukti. No, it's not eternal. It's not permanent. That point is also made in the Bhagavatam, and that's another verse which is used to defeat the impersonalists. How does that verse begin? 10.2.32, what is it? Sorry? 10.2.32, I think it is. Yein ye ramandakshava muktamaninas twayasta babad avashudaiva Avashuddha Buddhaya, Aruya Kritchrena, Parampadam Tata, Patantyada, Nadrata Yushmad Angrayaha. That these people, they achieve some sort of impersonal liberation, but Vimukta Manina, it's really just in their minds. They may be elevated in a certain sense, but it's really just within their minds. And patantyada, they fall down again from that position of imagined superiority or liberation. They fall down again because yen ye aravindaksha vimukta maninas, because they have no regard for your lotus feet. Patantyada, they fall down again. Yeah. No, it's just that they are presented in these different ways. Sometimes in prayers, in the form of prayers or via prayers. Sometimes in direct explanations, direct descriptions of the Lord. And sometimes in indirect. Sorry? No, it's just that in indirect explanations, like that story of Parikshit being saved. So in that explanation, indirectly, the Lord's mercy is being shown, isn't it? That he mercifully intervened and saved Parikshit. Yeah. So it's indirect in the sense that, you know, the context is the story of Uttara and Parikshit. That's the context. So the Lord's part, in terms of the context, is sort of indirect. The story's about Uttara and Parikshit. But still, one of the nine, or at least one of the nine, is shown. His mercy is shown in that indirect situation. If it's direct, then it's directly talking about him as a person, yeah, as an individual, not just as someone figuring in a sort of a greater incident or a broader incident. Sure. When there's it's in the context of a description of some other thing. Yeah. Bhattaji? Sorry, I missed that. Krishna can be. Yeah. For people to get impersonal liberation is a big thing. And they can't get it without the mercy of the Lord. Yes. That's right. Watch out. Be careful what you desire, because Krishna might fulfill your desire and you might end up in trouble. But you were thinking it would be very nice, but actually it's going to get you in trouble. Yes, of course. It's definitely personal enjoyment. Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's also, well, it's connected with mukti. The spiritual master, Krishna, take the reactions, basically, at the time of initiation. So that's a type of mukti. You're delivered from your karma. Sarva dharman paricha ja. Krishna's saying, give up other forms of religion, just surrender to me, and then I'll deliver you. Moksha yashami. You'll get liberation, moksha, mukti. So when one is initiated and one's reactions are taken, that is mukti. I mean, the element of mukti is extremely prominent, put it that way. Yeah. Iccha. I-C-C-H-A. Iccha means the desire of the Lord. His desire is, he wants the creation to happen again. Ultimately, so the living entities can go back to Godhead. Because while they're just within his body, they can't go back to Godhead. Yeah.
So it's like a personified desire of the Lord, which accompanies
him. It's his personal desire, the power of his desire. His desires are very powerful. Yes? So if... Okay. Yes. Yes. In all types of Puranas, Ashrayas there. Okay. So, tomorrow we'll do 58. It's very short. And I don't know, maybe we'll do 15, a bit of 59. Let's see how it goes. So if you want to read on, you could read over 58 and perhaps read over 59. Srila Prabhupada ki.